Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Imagine growing up in the household of Charles Darwin as one of his beloved children, 10 in all, from his happy and long marriage to his first cousin, Emma Wedgwood. The legacy of Darwin, with which most of us are familiar, is well known. His book on the origin of species has never been out of print, as it lays out one of the most far-reaching ideas conjured by a mere human, the theory of evolution by natural selection. By now, Darwin is more theory than man, the theory very familiar, the man not so much. Darwin expert Tim Barra, retired OSU biology professor, knows just about all there is to know about Darwin. And for his seventh book related to evolution and Darwin, Tim has decided to address the humanity of Darwin through the lives of his children from birth to death. Tim Barra also wrote Charles Darwin, The Concise Story of an Extraordinary Man, and visited the All Sides studio a few years ago to talk about that. He joins us again to talk about his new book, Darwin and His Children, His Other Legacy. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Ann. It's good to be here. That must mean I have another book out.
A pretty book.
Oh, the cover is beautiful. Yeah, that's Wedgwood Blue on the cover because Darwin is a Wedgwood and Wedgwoods are Darwins.
Right. Yeah, I mean, obviously it was his first cousin, so he's a Wedgwood too.
Well, his mother was a Wedgwood. Right. His grandfather, grandmother were Wedgwoods.
And it also is a Wedgwood dish, kind of a classical Wedgwood dish or plate, surrounds as like a frame the only known photograph of Darwin with one of his children.
That's right. That's his first son, William.
Which is surprising. Two of his kids loved photography.
Right.
He spent a lot of money. It was very expensive back then to set them up. And there's plenty of pictures of him, photographs of him and other people in the family, but none of him with any of his children.
Yeah, that's curious. They took his picture, but not with anybody around him.
Or that anyone's discovered yet?
Well, people have looked for a lot of years, and that's the only one that surfaced.
There aren't a lot of quote-unquote secrets about Darwin. The family was very, from the beginning, was very knowledgeable about the idea of his legacy and what it would mean going forward, and they were fastidious about keeping it.
Well, they were very protective of their father, and both Emma and Henrietta tried to sort of tone down his statements in various places so as not to offend the extended family, the servants, not to scandalize the public and so forth. And that's real interesting, too, of what things that Emma asked Francis to withhold from the autobiography of Charles Darwin. These things have now been put back in now that there's no Victorians left to be upset, you know.
Was his wife, Emma, offended? I mean, did it trouble their marriage that he, you know, theorized in this way and made of it what he did?
Well, Emma was devoutly religious in the Unitarian tradition and was a true believer, and she was a bit worried that Charles would not be with her forever because he didn't have these beliefs. And that worried her. I mean, she loved him very much and couldn't imagine eternity without her partner. But it didn't trouble the marriage or make problems. It's just that Charles was very perceptive and tiptoed around these issues with Emma and so forth.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Tim Barra. He's a retired OSU professor of evolution, ecology, and organismal biology, and the author of the book we're talking about now, Darwin and His Children, His Other Legacy. If you have a question or comment about Darwin, now's the time to call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. The family was plagued by ill health. Darwin was sick his whole life, every day. He was plagued as well with doubt about the origin of the bad health and whether or not it was related to the fact that his children were the product of two first cousins. He and his wife, Emma, first cousins, as we said, from the Wedgwood side of the family. Health in general or ill health plays a huge supporting role in the Darwin household.
Yes, there's always something going on. Somebody is always sick. Ill health seemed to be a lifestyle, and the children idolized Charles, and he was ill all the time. And how much of this was an imitation of their father's illness and hypochondria and so forth? But nevertheless, there were many, many episodes of serious illness, like scarlet fever. Almost all the children came
which
down
was
with
of
that.
The day, though.
That's right. Everybody at that time period. Charles had an interesting insight into all this because he was so heavily into plant breeding, and he realized that cross-pollinated plants produced much more vigorous offspring than self-fertilized plants, and more offspring and bigger and stronger and healthier. And he worried that, gee, I wonder if my marriage is, am I the source of my children's illness? He worried about things like that. But this really dominated the life of the kids. Henrietta was sick so often that at one point the physician who treated her, who was actually Queen Victoria and Prince Albert's physician and Charles's second cousin, he said, well, for a while, why don't you have breakfast in bed? She never again got up for breakfast the rest of her life. She stayed in bed. She had some very strange ideas about things, but, the family lived long lives for the most part.
Eight of the 10 children lived long, very well.
Yeah, three
seven,
died in
seven,
childhood.
Three died in childhood, seven, but the rest, whoever lived past childhood, lived a long life.
Oh, yeah. Well, Leonard lived until 1943. I mean, he's right there in, some people's time frame today.
Exactly. So what do we know about what was wrong with Darwin and his children? Was it the same thing necessarily as, or is it, you said, well, let me see. You wrote about one diagnosis, and I quote, because I could never just say this in a layperson's language, an A to G point mutation at nucleotide 3243 in a mitochondrial ring chromosome. And what the heck does that mean?
Well, this is the latest in a string of diagnoses at a distance. I mean, we really don't have the definitive answer, and people have speculated over the years. Chagas disease is considered a common diagnosis for Darwin. You'll pick up older books, and that's what they say
which
he
is
had. It's a parasitic infection caused by a trypanosome parasite, which is transmitted by the bite of the benchuca bug from South America, which bit him during the voyage of the Beagle.
It makes complete sense in that case.
It fits, but the symptoms aren't a good match for everything that bothered him all of his entire life.
Most of it had to do with intestinal problems.
Yes.
Him and the children.
Right. He vomited multiple times almost every day, and just a brief conversation with friends in the afternoon would keep him up all night and the evening, throwing up because he'd get upset and stimulated. There's really no good answer for this. Other things were that he had lactose intolerant or Crohn's disease inflammatory bowel disease. I mean, there's a whole list of suggestions out there. Some say it was all psychosomatic, that he made himself sick worrying about the upset his work was causing other people. We don't know for sure. But a good friend of mine who's a pathologist in Melbourne initially thought he had chronic vomiting syndrome, which actually was an episode on Grey's Anatomy, if you follow that a couple of years ago. Anyway, he diagnosed Charles with chronic vomiting syndrome, and now that has sort of led him to this mitochondrial disease. A mitochondrial disease is transmitted only through the maternal line. And so he's gone back and looked at Charles's mother, who died as a young woman, and the Wedgwood family and so forth. And he's now trying to track down female Darwin relatives to try and get a swab to see if they have this mutation and so forth. It's an interesting detective story.
It's interesting, too, that, all right, so three of them died young. Annie, the oldest one, died at the age of 10.
Correct.
The other two, one almost at birth, and then the other one lived for almost 2 years or a year and a half or something
months,
like
yeah.
that. Yeah. But the rest of them suffered something. And yet, from Charles Darwin, obviously, across the board, they were incredibly productive people.
Yes.
I mean, some of them were brilliant.
They were the world's authorities on some subjects. George Darwin, and I was a bit surprised as I got into this, George Darwin was the world's authority on tides. He was a mathematical, astronomical physicist who calculated the relationship of the Earth, Sun, and Moon and the effects of gravity and how that produces tides. And how the Earth would bulge as it spins around the sun, and how a large chunk of that may have been pulled out by the sun's gravity and left the Pacific Ocean basin in its place. Now, we know that isn't correct today. We have moon rocks and seismic activity and so forth to study. But for 50 years, his views held sway on this subject. He was the guy in that field.
I was surprised to read in your own introductions that there was a book about Charles Darwin's dogs, not yet his children. I had to ask, what was so interesting about his dogs?
Oh, that came out in 2009, which was the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. So all kinds of books came out, about, including mine, the Concise
the
Story
one,
of
right.
an Extraordinary
Man. The one we talked about before, yeah.
So this lady in England decided, she was a dog person and decided to write a book about his 15 or so dogs.
The way they educated their children was pretty typical. They were educated through the church at the outset and then sent away to boarding schools, or the girls stayed home and were educated by their mother or tutors and that sort of thing. But mostly, I mentioned it at the top of the hour, they were educated at his knee. I mean, they went on walks with him all the time, and that's how they learned their natural history.
Right. As children, they would take walks with their father along the Sandwalk, which was a trail around the 18 acres at Down House. And many of the children remarked on how interesting it was to watch their father walk, how quietly he walked, how perceptive he was, how he would notice butterflies and birds and plants and so forth. And the kids just loved this. And they remember the sound of his walking stick, clank, 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 with the metal tip hitting the Sandwalk and so forth. It was an idyllic childhood, but he never forced them into anything. They sort of just absorbed natural history by the intellectual surroundings that they found themselves in. Charles spent 8 years studying barnacles in his office laboratory every day, looking at these things, and his son George, playing with the neighbor's kids, asked, where does Sir John do his barnacles? That was just an normal
life. Well, the beginning of every chapter is like, and Charles was still working on his barnacles.
Yes,
and Charles was still working on his barnacles. It went on for basically seven or eight kids or something like that. He was still at work
so
on his barnacles.
So that was normal Darwin life.
My guest is Tim Bera, the author of a new book about Darwin's children, Darwin and His Children, His Other Legacy. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Tim Bera, the author of a new book about Charles Darwin. It's entitled Darwin and His Children, His Other Legacy. If you have a question or comment for Tim Bera, he's a retired OSU professor, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Both Charles Darwin and Emma were in about 30 when they married.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed unusually old, especially then to have 10 children. And I thought, wow, Emma was a trooper. Why so old? I mean, was that unusual at the time or maybe not?
Well, you got to remember, Charles was on the Voyage of the Beagle for nearly 5 years as a young man right out of college. So when he got home, he spent maybe a couple, 2 years organizing his specimens and beginning to work up his data. And at that point, he started thinking about getting married. And he made a list of the pros and cons, and somehow it turned out to be married was a longer list than not to be married. One of the choice things he thought of having a wife would be an object to be beloved and played with, better than a dog anyway, he said. And he had grown up with the Wedgwood kids, and his thoughts turned to Emma, his first cousin. And she accepted him immediately. They both knew what they were getting into. The Darwins and the Wedgwoods were so interrelated. And in fact, just prior to that, Emma's brother, Hensley Wedgwood, married Charles's sister, Susanna Darwin. So, you know, they all knew each other and were interrelated.
And so she knew what she was getting into as far as his work and his theory as well. That was something he brought up to her at the outset, but his father warned him not to.
Yes, his father, a physician, wealthy man, said, don't tell your wife about your lack of religious views, because women tend to worry about this, and that in turn makes the husband unhappy. So don't tell him. And of course, the first thing Charles did was sit down with Emma and explain that he didn't really accept things that could not be proven. And Emma accepted Charles because she realized that sincere questioning was a normal part of life.
When he was gone, he was gone. When he came back, he stayed back. The kids grew up with their dad around all the time.
Absolutely. He never went voyaging again. The Voyage of the Beagle was it. He then remained home almost constantly. He would take trips to London from Down, which was only 16 miles away, and they would take vacations as a family, but you know, they didn't really leave the vicinity.
Why has Annie, the one who died when she was 10, been singled out as an exception when it comes to his interest in his children? Much of the 2012 movie Creation dealt with their relationship.
Yeah. Well, that's a real interesting part of his story. She was his first daughter, second child, first daughter, and just a lovely little girl who was very empathetic and much like Emma, and she had a real love for her father. She would comb his hair and bring him treats, and you know, they had a wonderful relationship. And she was sick several occasions. She had scarlet fever and then got even worse and didn't respond to medical treatment. He took her for the water cure, which was the same treatment he took at a spa in Malvern near the border of Wales. And when she got so bad that medical treatment offered her no solution, he then took her there to stay and try and get better. And he stayed with her. Emma was pregnant, and she stayed at Down House with the rest of the children. And Annie was 10 years old at this time. And Charles was at her bedside daily as she went downhill. And he would write to Emma every day. Emma would reply the next day with questions. He would answer those questions. And there is a book called Annie's Box, which is what that movie was based on. It's about these letters. They're absolutely wonderful. It's a great book. To see the relationship between Charles and Emma and the incredible love and devotion and the sadness that goes through as Annie winds down her life and dies, you know, right there in Charles's arms practically. And he's devastated by this. He just never got over that death the rest of his life. And, of course, he was not predisposed to accept Christianity in any form. He didn't think revelation had any basis. It just wasn't a correct way to structure the world and so forth. But he could not accept this incredible suffering of children and death at an early age like this. And it was Annie's death that really pushed him away, destroyed any last vestige of religious belief in Charles.
You and I talked earlier, you were concerned, you said, with the depiction in that movie because it made him out as a morose person.
Yes.
And he was not a morose person. He was actually very fun-loving and happy.
Right. Well, the movie dwelled on that aspect of life. It didn't deal with the rest of his existence and all the other children. And I think it focused too much on that. But, it was entertaining in its own right for that purpose. But Darwin was way more than what's depicted there.
I loved his letters to his children the excerpts that I saw in your book. They were always so supportive, acknowledging their challenges if they had. And some of them did struggle with some things at times in their life. They weren't automatically, spawned geniuses. But he was so devoted to them. And I think that our stereotype of the Englishman, particularly of his class, was someone who was very distanced from their children.
He was not aloof, and he loved his children and encouraged them in everything they did, yet he never forced them into a category. When you look at the professions they chose, William, his first son, was a banker. And he was very successful as a banker for 40 years. He managed the Darwin and the Wedgwood finances.
Which obviously
were
amazing.
Huge. Well, Charles, towards the end there, he was worth, in today's terms, over $20 million. I mean, he was not a poor man. And this was part of his success because he really didn't have to go out and earn a living. He had enough to do the research without worrying about that. George, as I mentioned, was a mathematician and an astronomer. Francis was the world's authority on plant hormones and more or less created the field of plant physiology and popularized it and got it taught at Cambridge. Leonard was a major in the army for 20 years. He was an elected member of parliament. He was a patron of genetic research. He was sort of the sponsor of Sir Ronald Fisher, who was part of the new synthesis combining Mendel's genetic work with Darwin's natural selection theory. Horace Darwin was a tinkerer as a child. He would make things. He loved machinery. Well, he went on to found the Cambridge Scientific Instrument Company, which put England in the same category as Germany as a world-class instrument maker. And then during World War I, his company did all sorts of good things for the development of aviation and instruments and so forth. And he was knighted for that. Three of his children, George, Francis, and Horace, were knighted and were elected fellows of the Royal Society.
William Darwin, born in 1839, died in 1914. He was the exception to the rule of the illness. He's the one that managed their finances. He did not suffer from ill health.
No. The usual Darwin hypochondria didn't seem to hit him yet, maybe because he was the first child and didn't see all the other behaviors that went on, But one interesting thing about William, immediately when he was born, Charles Darwin, the naturalist, started observing his behavior.
I was going to bring that up.
And would record notes of how William would react to tickling or to the approach of Emma's breast, how his, lips would form the sucking motion and so forth. And Charles was basically recording a natural history of babies.
He did it for almost all of his children.
Well, he did it for William and Annie.
Okay.
And these observations ended up in a journal article later on.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Tim Barrow. We're talking about his new book, Darwin and His Children, His Other Legacy. If you have a question or comment, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go on to Facebook and post your question or comment there. And, of course, you can Twitter us as well. At WOSU All Sides. So lots of options if you'd like. I say you should say you can tweet us as well. All right, so he took notes on his kids. It was the sort of thing we do in albums where we record a child's first step and little put in little locks of their hair. But this was an anthropologist.
Well, yeah, Darwin the scientist, right, looking at his children, just like you would record the observations of an orangutan, you know, which he did and compared with William. I'm sure that delighted Emma.
You wrote that in Charles' later years, William acted on his father's behalf to prevent the use of Darwin's name in unwanted endorsements on hot political topics. Like what? What did you mean there?
Oh, there were things politically in England going on. For example, there was the Eyre affair. John Eyre was a politician who was running, I think, Jamaica at the time, and he put down a rebellion in slavery. And Charles was, of course, very much against slavery. And there were people wanting to get the Darwin name involved in this and so forth. William was sort of protective of this thing. Another event like this would be the vivisection. People were against work and experiment on animals and so forth, anti-vivisections. And, of course, Charles Darwin never did any of that work, but they wanted to use his name and so forth.
Well, his daughter Henrietta was part of that movement.
Was part of that, and Charles sort of calmed her down about that, saying how that would interfere with knowledge of physiology and so forth. And Thomas Huxley, the great friend of Darwin, Darwin's bulldog, was also involved in this. And Huxley would complain of how a teacher using the webbing in a frog's foot to explain to the class circulation and so forth would be in more trouble than an angler who put a hook through the frog to catch a fish. You know, and I think of that. We still fight these battles today. You know, you got to have animal ethics committees come and look at your laboratory and your aquarium and how you're keeping your fish and what you're going to do. Yet an angler can go out and tart your fish any way he wants. Things haven't changed that much.
You know, William married as well, but much later in life and to someone his own age. That was surprising. They were in their late 30s or 40s,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah, and that was a family friend that got introduced to him maybe 7-8 years earlier, and finally he did it, you know. And all the Darwin choices of mates were quite interesting. Francis Darwin had 3 wives, and he outlived all of them.
Francis, that was made me sad.
Oh, it was one was a very, very sad story. His marriage to Amy Ruck, and she died in childbirth with their first son at Downhouse. I mean, she was brought in to deliver the baby with Charles and Emma surrounding and helping, and she got an infection, and 4 days later, she was dead with this newborn baby. I mean, Francis was devastated. Charles was very upset. The whole family was thrown into upset. And here now Emma, who was, 69 or so at the time, had another baby to raise. You know, it was just a horrible situation.
But, of course, there was Henrietta there to help.
Henrietta and Elizabeth, the other daughter, lived at home and helped take care. Interestingly, the child, Bernard, grew up to become a golfer and golfing correspondent for the Times of London. You know, he was an interesting guy in his own right.
Prakash in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'd like to know, very interesting conversation. I'd like to know about the current children or direct lineage of Charles Darwin and any successful male direct lineage with the name Darwin.
Are there any?
Oh, yeah, there are Darwins all around. But interestingly, when you trace the lineage of people named Darwin today, all the name traces back to one of the Darwin sons, George. He is the only one from whom the Darwin name is perpetuated. The other children of Darwin's children were either females or left no offspring or died before leaving offspring. So that Darwin's alive today, all trace their lineage back to George. And in 2009, I was the keynote speaker at the Darwin Symposium at Charles Darwin University at Darwin Auditorium in Darwin, Australia. Now, I thought it couldn't get any more Darwin than that. And after my lecture, I was introduced to a person in the audience who was Charles Darwin's great-great-great-grandson, who lives in Sydney and came up for this conference, and we had dinner, and he's a long descendant of George Darwin.
Do the Darwins and the descendants of Darwin, do they stay in touch? Is there a society of descendants of Darwin?
I don't know for sure, and I think there is a Darwin Wedgwood family entity out there that does get together,
because,
at least
wow,
is aware.
Darwin and Wedgwood, let's face it, they're household names to this day for completely different reasons.
Yeah. Well, I got to find that plaque that's on the cover of my book. I want to own that Wedgwood plate because now it means something to me. I have a little Wedgwood collection, but I've got to find that particular plate with that tree on the side of it and so forth. It's really beautiful.
It is. It's a beautiful plate. I'm talking with Tim Bera. We're talking about his new book. It's called Darwin and His Children, His Other Legacy. Thank you, Prakash, for your question. And if anybody else has a question, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Tim Bera. He's the author of a new book about Charles Darwin. It's entitled Darwin and His Children, His Other Legacy. I should say Tim is retired from teaching, but not his research. He travels and he's preparing for another trip to Australia, is it?
I'm off again. In fact, on Darwin's birthday, February 12th, which, by the way, is the same date and year as Abraham Lincoln. February 12th, I'll be back in Australia in Darwin at Charles Darwin University giving a series of lectures, including a launch of the book in Australia and so forth, and doing field work.
I mentioned earlier that On the Origin of Species has never gone out of print, ever.
Neither has The Voyage of the Beagle.
Right. Neither of them. There's ongoing interest in what exactly he said.
Yeah, and there probably always will be because, evolution by natural selection is really the basis of all modern day biology, including medicine, agriculture, biotechnology. It all depends on that concept. That's what roots everything that we do. So he'll always be important. And then as far as The Voyage of the Beagle goes, it's one of the greatest travel narratives you'll ever read. I mean, that's what hooked me as a kid. I read that. The origin is bloody tough going. You got to really want to finish that book.
Ergo the wonder in my voice.
Yes, yeah, it's hard to read.
Never out of print. Henrietta really got, as we mentioned earlier, got into the animal cruelty movement. She vivisection was something she disagreed on, but I have to say she was one of the most interesting personalities to me. I mean, obviously she was a very, very intelligent, productive woman in an age that did not value that. We have a clip here, courtesy of the Darwin Correspondence Project. A voice actor reading a letter that Charles Darwin wrote to his daughter, Henrietta, who is helping him edit his book, The Descent of Man.
After reading once right through, the more time you can give up for deep criticism or corrections of style, the more grateful I shall be. Please make any long corrections on separate slips of paper. leaving narrow blank edge, and pin them to margin of each sheet so that I can turn each back and read while still attached to its proper page. This will save me a world of troubles. Heaven only knows what you will think of the whole, for I cannot conjecture. You're a very good girl indeed to undertake the job. Your affectionate father, C. Darwin.
I mean, the poor guy, if he'd only had, you know, Word.
Well, he actually paid her for her editing. Mm-hmm. He would give her 20, 30 pounds from the royalties because he valued her comments. And I believe that passage is actually in my book here if I thumb through
it. Yes, it is.
She was an excellent editor, and she was basically homeschooled. The girls were not sent to university in those days. But the teachers were hired and would specialize in making them gentlewomen, and that included, you know, English and grammar. And she even corrected some of Huxley's work and pointed out errors in his book, and he used to really enjoy that and admired her ability. And she went on to edit her mother's, create her mother's biography by collecting all of the letters from Emma Darwin. They were prolific letter writers. They would always write letters every day to somebody. And she assembled these in a two-volume work about Emma Darwin.
Hakeem in, I'm sorry, where are you from, Hakeem?
Copley, Ohio.
Okay, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for the program. It's very informative.
Thank you.
My question was Darwin's involvement with eugenics. Was it I know in Hitler's Germany, there were scientists and others that were involved in some work where they pulled out of Darwin's theories of natural selection and survival of the fittest.
Now,
that's my question.
Leonard got into eugenics.
Yes. It wasn't Charles. There's a lot of connection here that's confusing. First of all, the founder of the eugenics movement was Sir Francis Galton, and Galton was a cousin of Darwin. And it was Galton who proposed eugenics as a way of studying human heredity and so forth. And then Leonard became the second president after Galton died of the Eugenics Education Society, and his views on eugenics, I guess today would be a bit shocking to our sentiments, because he was making statements to the effect that the way a person manages money would be a good indicator of who should propagate the next generation, because if you can support yourself and maintain your money, you have the attributes that we need in our society, and blah, blah, blah. And Gwen Ravenrat, who wrote this wonderful book called Period Peace, she was the granddaughter of Charles Darwin. She was the daughter of George. And she recorded all of her uncle's lives at Downhouse as she was growing up. And she writes about that. She used to argue with Uncle Lenny about this because she would say, you know, philosophers and people like that don't care that much about money, and we don't want them bred out of the population and so forth. But there's really no sensible connection between Charles Darwin and the theory of evolution and Nazi Germany and so forth. That's just a perversion of science.
Hakeem, thank you very much for your call. There was another story put out there by an evangelist that Darwin had a deathbed conversion. It's still out there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because how great would that be to, you know, but repeatedly the family has said, no way.
True. This is a myth that has been circulated by fundamentalist preachers, originally thought up by this rather mysterious and shady woman identified as Lady Hope. She claims that she visited Darwin at his deathbed, and he was reading the Bible and singing hymns, and it's just a bizarre concoction. Well, I mean, it's not true. And Henrietta and Francis Darwin, along with Emma and Elizabeth, were at Darwin's death in 1882 at his side. and they recorded his words and so forth. And they, you know, they dismiss this as a total fabrication. But yet, you'll see little religious tracts. I've got one that is in my collection of, you know, spouting this as a way to draw an audience to fundamentalist rallies and so forth. But it's just not factual.
What was expected of the children when it came to religious education? How were they educated, and how did most of them turn out in terms of their own beliefs?
Oh, that's interesting. None of them were overtly religious. And in fact, several, Elizabeth, Henrietta, specifically stated they didn't accept this concept of a personal God and so forth, and would refuse. I think Elizabeth refused confirmation and so forth. Yet they were brought up by Emma, taken to church, baptized, and so forth. And then the sons were all in more or less the scientific vein and really didn't have much use for this. I think they took their clues from their father and the class of people they dealt with. This was, again, one of the things, besides the death of Annie, the other thing that bothered Charles about religious belief was that how his friends, his father, his grandfather, his brother would all be condemned to hell because they didn't have religious beliefs. And he thought that was just weird because he knew them to be very good people. And so he just didn't have much truck for this concept.
You call Elizabeth Darwin the most enigmatic Darwin.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, we don't know anything about her.
She, why don't we? Why?
Well, she, I guess I, it might be unfair, but she didn't do anything. She just she just sat around the house. She was a spinster who never left the Darwin household. She grew up in the family and stayed there. She was there at Charles's death. She then lived with Emma. Emma moved to Cambridge to be near the sons. Elizabeth moved with her. When Emma died, she stayed there. We don't know anything about her. She would read to her nieces and nephews. She took care of Charles. That was sort of her duty with Emma, to take care of her father. There is one interesting thing that I didn't know about until I did this research, was that how Elizabeth would flutter her fingers when she got upset and then bring them close to her head and, you know, sort of wave the fingers in an excited gesture. And Charles did exactly the same thing, yet He knows that she never saw him do it because he kept this hidden. It was a nervous tic. When he was excited, he would do this. And he wrote about this in his book, and he said that he and his daughter were the only two people he ever heard of who had that particular nervous tic.
But there was a sense that she was intelligent.
Yes, but, you know, it runs both ways. You have people making comments that she was not terribly bright. On the other hand, that she was extremely perceptive of character and attuned to people. She basically lived life through other people and her reading. And, I mean, she would read books in French, and she wasn't stupid, but she was odd. I think that's probably a good adjective for her. She was a little odd. And the family loved her dearly because she was so needy for affection and so forth.
In Leonard's obituary in Nature magazine, it was said that he bore a closer resemblance to his father physically and in his attitude toward life than any of the other children.
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with that when I look at the other photos. I think William looks more like Charles than Leonard did. And then who was the real naturalist in the family besides Charles? Who observed nature the way Charles did? And that might have been Francis.
Who got into the plants.
Yes. I mean, each of these kids was a Darwin in his own way. You know, there was no mold into which they had to fit. And that was the beauty of this family. They were free to develop however they wanted. And yet they were also loyal to the family and so aware of the importance of their father.
By the time Horace was born in 1851, the ninth child, you wrote that Charles was still working on the barnacles, which cracked me up. There's a really interesting story about when he was just 11 years old, when Horace was just 11 years old, and he made an interesting observation regarding natural selection in adders, the natural selection of cowards. And it actually, I thought it was amazing.
I did, too.
Amazing that a child thought this way.
This is the sort of thing that I didn't know before I started doing this book. And as I read and found these stories, I was just excited. And it's something to the effect where he's talking to his father, and he said, you know, if fewer adders would bite, there would be less deaths. And Charles said, yeah, because there'd be less adders. And he made the connection that, no, that this would be a selection for those who didn't bite. And Charles said, oh, yeah, the natural selection of cowards. And I thought, this kid got it instantly, and he was just a child. I mean, I wish our students would grasp natural selection so intuitively.
Yeah, it was interesting. He grew up to be a designer.
Yes, the machinist who founded mm-hmm. Cambridge Scientific Instrument Company.
Right, right. Also sickly.
Yeah, well, they were Darwins. Of course they were sick.
You know, I wanted to go back just briefly to Francis because I know his plant physiology accomplishments and plant physiology were unparalleled at the time. And he had that very sad love life, though, and I thought it would make a great miniseries.
Yeah, it would be a tearjerker. I mean, he remarried after a few years when Bernard was now an infant, or not an infant, but a toddler, 3 or 4 years old. And his second wife died after a few years, and they had a child, too. So there again, he was left to raise another child after the death of a wife that he dearly loved. So, yeah, you know, that he didn't have an easy life. And he had trained as a medical doctor, and he was present at his father's death, couldn't find a pulse. And he explained to little Bernard, who was still growing up in Downhouse with grandfather and so forth, he says that grandfather has been so sick that he won't be sick anymore. And I thought that was an interesting way to announce the death of grandfather Charles.
Tell us about Darwin's niece who wrote so extensively about the brothers. Where'd she come from?
Well,
because, gosh, so many of your references go back to her.
Right. That's Gwen Ravenrat. I mean, she was Gwen Darwin in the sense of George Darwin's daughter, mm-hmm. but she later married Jox Ravenrat and became famous as Gwen Ravenrat. She really did a lot of things. She, did a lot of research into the family's life, but she lived among them at Downhouse and recorded her impressions. And she was an artist, and she drew little drawings of events in the lives of the family and so forth. And she was very perceptive of the differences between each of her uncles and aunts. And this book, period piece, goes chapter by chapter for each of her relatives.
Just like you did with the children.
Well, that was part of my inspiration. I mean, I had read that book years ago. That and Annie's Box are my two favorite Darwin books. So you got to read both of those. And it made me think that here is some information about these older Darwin children. Maybe I can find even more and flesh out a little, say, mini biography of each individual.
I enjoyed it. Thank you so much for joining us today, Tim Barra.
You mean we're done?
Yeah.
Right, just getting started.
Tim Barra, he is retired from teaching at OSU, but not his research. He is a professor emeritus of evolution, ecology, and organismal biology, and author of Darwin and His Children, His Other Legacy. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.